I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of March. Do you remember how to diagram a sentence? Are we still teaching young people how to diagram sentences? Our guest this hour says there may be a better way to teach grammar. Michelle Navar-Cleary is Associate Professor and Associate Dean at DePaul University's School for New Learning and a fellow with the Op-Ed Project. She wrote a piece in The Atlantic that caught our attention, The Wrong Way to Teach Grammar, and it says a century of research shows traditional grammar lessons, hours spent diagramming sentences and memorizing parts of speech, don't help and may even hinder students' efforts to become better writers. We need to learn grammar, but the old-fashioned way does not work. So what is the new way to do all of this, and why is it better? We'll talk about that this hour of the program and welcome your phone calls. I would imagine you'll have more than a lot to say because so many of us, if you're of a certain age, you went through a lot of this diagramming sentences. Is it still being taught? Should it be? What do we learn from that? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Michelle. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. The woman, Judith Sears-Poisson, who produced this show, put a diagram of what exactly did she say on her Facebook page? And I looked at it and I thought, ooh, I would not be here without Wisconsin Public Radio. And the way it's diagrammed correctly, I'm sure. And I grew up learning how to do this and I can't even remember what it is anymore. I mean, I don't have a clue. I looked at it and said, oh my gosh, what is this?
Right.
How long have we been teaching diagramming as a way to learn grammar?
Well, I should say it's not taught everywhere, but there are still places where folks are learning grammar by diagramming. And actually, the bigger point is insisting and having students learn grammar, memorize grammar rules, memorize all those rules for where the commas go, et cetera, before really getting students to write. And the issue is that we've known for quite a long time that that doesn't work. If the goal is to make better writers, that having this idea that you have to teach grammar first and writing second does not work. And there are some places that are doing marvelous things with folks with writing. But the frustration from someone like myself and others who know the research is the fact that in many places people are still, you know, insisting on grammar first and building curriculum around that. And the result is people who are terrified to write.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your personal experience. You write in the article that you saw firsthand at Urban Community College, where you taught writing for a number of years, an institution where more than 90% of students failed to complete a two-year degree within 3 years, partially because of the writing, right? They were just so afraid to write that they couldn't do it. And I would imagine a lot of people just drop out.
Right. Well, what happens is that students who come into, in particular, this Urban Community College, who've been in schools where they haven't had a lot of practice writing already, test into developmental writing classes. And in this case, in this system, those classes are structured so that in your first semester, you focus on sentences. In your second semester, you focus on paragraphs. Mm. And then you can move up to a short essay. So those students are you know, they're bored to death. But also they're terrified of making mistakes. They're not actually writing. Now, it's the case that there are many instructors within that system who are doing different things, but the curriculum itself is set up in a way that doesn't reflect what we know about how people learn writing, and in a way that is just so discouraging for them.
Mm-hmm. So what is the best way to do it? To just write and then learn what the rules are? Or to read a whole lot and see what the rules are?
Well, both. we know that, you know, the reason writing is really hard is not the grammar. The reason writing is really hard is that good writing is clear thinking. Mm. And most folks, you start out with an idea and you think you know what it is, and then you start to write it down on the page and it kind of falls apart because you really haven't thought it through as far as you think you have. I compare this to those times when you wake up and you've had this like perfect dream, and as soon as you go to tell someone the perfect dream, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because
you lost it.
Actually all the little spots didn't fill in.
Mm-hmm.
So getting people to write, getting them to then share their writing with others and have people ask them questions is where they start to realize that there's gaps and they need to fill in the gaps. And it's in that effort to communicate that people start to learn what makes sense in terms of arranging their words in sentences that are going to clearly communicate.
You mentioned a couple of programs in the article, and they incorporate the elements of what you just said, but tell us more about them. One at Arizona State, where students who test below college level in writing begin writing college essays immediately. Why do you mention that particular program?
Because they've had a lot of success. So in contrast to that other program I talked to you about, where this developmental program takes so long for students to move from you know, where they're just focusing on grammar to actually writing and the students drop out. At Arizona State, they've had a lot of success because they have students writing college-level writing essays right away and then giving them feedback on their writing and working with them on the nuances of grammar as it's specific to their writing. And those students are more successful in completing that first-year composition sequence than the students who don't test into developmental writing, who come in with apparently stronger writing skills.
And Michelle, what about the Community College of Baltimore?
Right. The program that is started at the Community College of Baltimore, this is was started by a professor named Peter Adams, who started looking at the data. He started looking at how many students do not progress through the developmental writing sequence at their school, and was sort of shocked and distraught. And so started to experiment with different ways to help these students. And what they have set up is that they put a cohort of 8 students who are developmental writing students into a composition class. So those students have some community with each other, but they're in the regular composition class, and then those students meet for an additional section on another day of the week, just those students with someone, instructor who's helping them. Interestingly, what he's found is that in helping those students be successful, it's not only addressing the their challenges with writing, but it's also talking with those students about all the other barriers that are up in their way to get to school. So, you know, these students at the community colleges sometimes are facing, you know, just transportation barriers, childcare barriers, lots of issues. So they're in that pilot, they're addressing the kind of the affective issues as well as the cognitive issues. And they've also been successful. This is now spread through a number of different schools. Mm-hmm. And it's called ALP, the Accelerated Learning Program.
Mm. And what about those schools that are still teaching the method of diagramming sentences and memorization of grammar rules that it was a traditional form of instruction for years and years and years, I would imagine? Who still adheres to that?
You know, I think it happens in pockets, and it happens also with individual teachers. It was interesting when I looked at my article in the comments section. There were comments from folks saying, no one does this anymore. And then 2 comments down, there would be, I'm a teacher, and absolutely she's wrong. You have to teach grammar first.
Right.
And then there'd be, you know. So it's, I think, how we've been taught is often how we teach people. And with the absence of a lot of clear information about what the research is and practice implementing that, people often go back to how they've been taught. And diagramming sentences, when I wrote this, all of my friends who are English teachers or writers said, but I love diagramming sentences. And so did I. It made sense to us because we were already into language. But it doesn't work for everyone. But sometimes that's hard to remember when you're teaching, and you tend to teach what made sense to you.
Oh, I found it so boring. I really did. It was boring as heck to diagram those sentences. Let's go to phone calls. As you might imagine, we have a ton of response to this, Michelle. Lots of phone calls, lots of emails coming in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We've also posted the article from The Atlantic on our Facebook page in case you would like to read it first or read it while we're talking. That'd be great. And you can see more fully what she is proposing. Michelle Navarre-Cleary is our guest, associate professor, associate dean at DePaul University School for New Learning and a fellow with the Op-Ed Project. The Wrong Way to Teach Grammar is the article in The Atlantic. Christine in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Well, I have 2 points. One is I loved diagramming sentences, but that's just me.
That's okay.
It makes sense to me.
Okay.
It kind of seemed like a scientific type thing, and that's me. I'm 28 years old, and I learned it in high school, and it just made sense to me. But the question I have is, now that with technology and everything advancing, and especially with cell phones and people texting and everything, how has that changed grammar and spelling now? Is it getting worse, and how are you having to overcome kind of grammar, those kind of grammar, hiccups, if you will, from people learning how to type and text and everything like that first? Are you having to overcome those kind of hiccups and break those bad habits? So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Christine.
Sure. So the school I teach at is for adults who are coming back to school. Excuse me. And so they tend to be a little bit older. And so we get that kind of stuff a little bit later. But no matter what practice folks are coming from, that shapes how they think about writing. So a lot of our students come from the business world. So they do a lot of business writing, which means they write in a lot of fragments and bullet points. So yes, no matter what practice people have had, that's what they often bring with them. It works in the context they're in the business context or on the texting or the Twitter. But it's the important thing is to help folks learn that as they move into different situations, like a classroom, they have a different audience, who have different expectations, and they have to adjust their writing accordingly. So it's helping people to figure out how to, you know, who is my audience, what's my purpose, what am I trying to do, and then make the changes that they need to make in how they structure their sentences, their spelling, etc. So yes, I know it has, because I've heard from my colleagues who work with younger students. But it's not that different from any other thing in which people are moving from one context to another.
I'd like to read to you, this is fairly lengthy, but it's very thoughtful and expresses things that I never thought about when it comes to this issue. It's from our Facebook page. Mavis posted this. Reading and creative writing certainly can improve grammar, but it does not address grammatical analytical skills or speak to the visual learner the way diagramming does. Students who have grammatical analytical skills can name and apply parts of speech, have a much better grasp of correctly learning to speak and write a second language. She's a former teacher. My world language teaching experience is on the high school level. Having also taught high school creative writing, I have experienced that students write the way they talk, which is too often in colloquialisms that are not grammatically correct and therefore not publishable until edit. Who edits? Not the author, who may bring wonderful creative ideas to the table, but the grammatical analyst. So now it takes two people to produce the final product. When one is speaking, two people are not available before the words come out of our mouth. Try the correct use of who, whom, with someone exposed only to reading and creative writing. That's an interesting comment.
Yes. One of the things that works for teaching students grammar, and I think she's connected there, is teaching them,
Bless
how
you.
To edit.
Was that sneezing?
No.
Oh, cough. Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
You know.
Yeah,
just,
yeah. Cold.
Right, but teaching students how to edit their own writing and the writing of others, right? Because she's absolutely right that how for everyone, not just students, writes at first, is that voice in their head, which is very much often the voice, the speaking voice.
Right.
So getting practice, starting to edit and revise, having other people read your writing and ask you, what do you mean here? Are you sure you want to say it this way? Is the way to help students learn that analytical skill she's talking about, which are really the skills that are going to help a person continue to become an improving writer no matter what they're writing for. Just like that the previous caller, these students have to know and transition between writing for different teachers, writing in the workplace, and so they need to be able to think about what works in those different contexts mm-hmm. and be able to revise.
Frank in Bayview, hi. Frank?
Well, hi.
Hi, Frank. You want to put yourself on a regular phone because you sound like you're at the bat.
Yeah, I got to turn my speaker.
Okay, Frank. Hi.
Yeah. I'm a former English teacher, 34 years, and when this article came out, a bunch of my students Facebooked me and told me, well, geez, you liked diagramming when you taught it. And, of course, that was a course called grammar. But I've seen... I think the reason why people obsess, now really what we're obsessing about is usage, not grammar. Because grammar is just a way to describe what the human mind does. And we tend to make subjects and we tend to make verbs and we put them in this kind of order. That's all grammar is. Usage is the who and whom thing. And I think what it's driven by the people who try to pound the rules is really the ACT test. In England, for instance, they'll let you use a semicolon just because you really want everybody to slow down. In America, you have to use a semicolon for in between two independent clauses because on the ACT test, that's going to be one of the questions. Huh. Now, let me just tell you a fast story. One time I walked into the English office and a student teacher was crying. I said to her, why are you crying? She goes, this grammar is driving me crazy. I don't know what to do. Okay, I said, I'm good at grammar. Explain it to me. She said, look at this rule. You use a comma after two or three introductory phrases. And then she sobbed and said, what do I tell the kids? Should I tell them two or should I tell them three?
Oh,
and
no.
What if they don't go to college because they got screwed on the ACT test?
Oh, no.
And see, the whole thing is, what the grammar book was saying is, it's a matter of style. And what we've, I think the people who are teaching grammar a lot of times really don't understand exactly what they're teaching, and they're worried more about, like I say, their kids being assessed on an ACT and then not going to college. I could talk about this forever, but I think that's going to be my point, and I'll just put my speaker back on and listen to you guys.
All right, thank you. Thanks. Good point. Michelle.
Yeah. There's an example of having to teach to the test, right?
Right.
Which I escape by being in college instead of high school. Yeah.
You know, I forgot about the semicolon. I can't remember the last time I used a semicolon.
Yeah, I've banned it in my classes. I said, you can't use the semicolon until you know exactly what it's for and can tell me, because for some reason, my students, all of a sudden, they read about the semicolon, they go semicolon happy.
That's funny. Thank you, Frank, very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. The Wrong Way to Teach Grammar in the current issue of The Atlantic, the author of the piece, who's associate professor and associate dean at DePaul University's School for New Learning, a fellow with the Op-Ed Project, is our guest. She writes that there have been hundreds of studies among students of all ages. One study she cites followed three groups of students from 9th through 11th grade. One group had traditional rule-bound grammar lessons, a second, an alternative approach to grammar instruction, and a third, no grammar lessons at all, just more literature and creative writing. The result, no significant differences among the three groups, except that both grammar groups emerged with a strong antipathy to English. What do you think? How do we learn grammar then? If we just are going to do creative writing and lots of reading, there are certain kinds of rules. And as our guest said, we do have the ACT test, and you got to pass it And if you don't know the semicolon, or if you got problems with your comma use, or if grammatically you're way off the mark, then you may not pass. That might be an overstatement, but it certainly will be a problem for you. So when do we learn the rules that govern our language? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to Carl joining us from Mexico. Hi, Carl.
Hi there.
Hi.
I hope I'm coming through clear.
You're very clear.
Yeah. I just want to make the point that that old-time, sometimes boring diagramming, it comes in handy when you go to your second or third language.
Mm.
Because you can relate, this is that, real quick.
And, yeah. I think I read that in some of the comment sections to your article that for foreign, didn't you as well, Michelle?
Yes. Yeah, and I think that I think a lot of people actually really learn grammar when they learn a second language. That's when it starts to click for them, because they the rules that they have not fully kind of acknowledged to themselves that they're often using get made explicit when they're learning another language. Mm-hmm. So I'm all for learning additional languages. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Carl, did you learn the diagramming English method or some other way?
It was the old-time diagramming method, but I paid attention, and my classmates at that time were saying, "What the heck is we need this for? It's not important." And then guess who was using English properly and who wasn't?
Right. Well, and diagramming, like anything else, diagramming clicks for some people and it doesn't for others.
Mm-hmm.
But the real key is that. Is for people to be writing, is to get them writing and playing with what their words on their paper, and thinking about that and how they're communicating. My daughter a couple of years ago diagrammed sentences, but it was her sentences she was diagramming to help self-diagnose those sentences.
Hmm.
And it wasn't me who assigned it; it was her teacher.
Mm-hmm. So, is there a problem with stifling creativity if you learn the grammar first? Are there a lot of students that you've had or studies mm-hmm. show that if you learn all of these, you're so uptight about where the comma goes and where the semicolon or colon goes, and that you mess up the creative process?
Yeah, and not even the creative process, but just thinking. What happens is that students, writers, get so caught up with, you know, is this the right word? Is this correct? Is this proper? That they're not actually letting their ideas develop and explore those ideas. It's almost, in a way, a kind of a convenient procrastination technique. It's much easier, you know, as painful as grammar can be for people, it's easier to worry about where the comma goes than to really push yourself to clarify your ideas sometimes, because that's really hard and messy. But I wanted to read you, if you don't mind, I have this,
sure.
Some quotes from a study about the difference between how novice writers talk about revising and how experienced writers talk about it. And I think it really captures that idea that focusing on getting things correct stops folks right when they should be launching off into exploring their ideas. So here's just an example. A novice writer says that, you know, to revise means scratching out and cutting out. I read what I've written and I cross out a word and put another word in, a more decent word or a better word. And then if there's somewhere to use a sentence that I've crossed out, I will put it there. Whereas a more experienced writer is saying that revising is a matter of looking at the kernel of what I've written, the content, and then thinking about it, responding to it, making decisions, and actually restructuring it. Someone else says, I write as I rewrite. So when students are so focused on getting the correctness, not only are they kind of not exploring their ideas, but they get so committed to those sentences that they're then not willing to scratch them out and toss the whole thing because, actually, you know what? That paragraph doesn't really have anything to do with what they were supposed to, what they were trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Here's an email from John in Janesville. Some of these are kind of long, but they're good. In math, when solving word problems, sometimes the most challenging part is gathering the information that's presented in the English words and translating them into a math equation, which is basically mm-hmm. another language. I've used the idea of diagramming sentences when trying to solve word problems. The verb is usually the equals sign, and many mm-hmm. times it's necessary to understand things like what is a subordinate clause, which describes something else in the English description. I strongly encourage continuing diagramming sentences so students continue to know these topics. What do you think?
So teaching diagramming sentences so people could do math word problems?
I guess, yeah.
Sure. I'm not so much arguing against teaching diagramming or anything else. What I'm arguing for is getting people writing right away and then bringing in those other tools as ways to help them think about and develop their writing, and that they're going to learn the grammar as they're doing that. So if diagramming is something that works for some folks, great. But have them writing and revising, sharing their writing with other people, having people ask them questions, getting feedback. So let me give one example.
All right.
A common problem are sentence fragments, right? And run-on sentences. Mm-hmm. Sentence fragments, very often it's because the thinking stopped and the writer hasn't completed their idea, and they need someone else to ask them a question to help them realize, oh, okay, I need to say how this happened or where it happened or connect it. Similarly, with run-on sentences, often they haven't sort of, they're running on because they haven't sorted out their ideas and they haven't thought about what that email just talked about. What are the more important ideas? What are the less important ideas? They haven't thought about subordinating and focusing on the more important ideas.
All right. Thanks, Carl, very much for coming through clearly from Mexico. Joe and Perry mm-hmm. Sheen, hi.
Hi. I went to school in the 60s, and we were taught this. And in the high school, we were introduced to E.E. Cummings. And we all, mm-hmm. the class, I realized, we all loved it because he was bucking the rules. And he
right,
still got
right.
his ideas across.
Right.
And it struck us as a great way just to express yourself without having to follow specific patterns. And I think that was a very good educational process I went through. Mm.
But what about following the rules? Do you follow them now, Joe?
I try to. I listen to Away with Words and so on NPR.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's fun. Language is fluid.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
yes.
mathematics, and you have to adapt. And
yeah.
I think it's a good lesson in life to be flexible.
Right. There are no rules with a capital R, really. They change, they alter. If you get any two grammar people or linguists in a room, they'll debate to high heavens what is even the basic parts of speech. So he's absolutely right that learning that flexibility and learning to be able to play with language and make it work for what you're trying to communicate. I had that same experience, and we were irate in our class because our teacher was very strict about following the rules and then shared with us E.E. Cummings. And we're like, well, wait a second. This is your example, but what?
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Joe, very much for the call. What about usages of certain words or almost idiosyncrasies that people use to fill time, or they just want to keep talking mm-hmm. and talking? How do you mm-hmm. recommend when you have students, if they're using, this is one that drives me crazy, and I don't know why it's in such widespread use right now. It's so incorrect, grammatically incorrect. We're not just talking commas and semicolons, just the use of words. Me and Joe went to the store. I hear it all the time among young mm-hmm. people. I don't know where it came from. If you are a teacher and you hear that, and I'm sure you do all the time from mm-hmm. some students, mm-hmm. how do you learn that kind of usage? How can somebody be so off? The other person always comes first is the way I try to think of it.
You learn it because that's how folks speak around you, right?
I see.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Chicago and we're forever ending our sentences with prepositions and saying, you know, where are you at? And the key is, right, it sounds right to the speaker. Sometimes when students write like that and then I have them read it out loud, they correct themselves.
Oh, do they?
They go, oh, wait.
Interesting.
And then they make the change.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Should you correct people when you hear that or not?
Well, it depends. Are you at the grocery store in line?
It's somebody you know. Let's say it's,
yeah.
It's somebody you know.
Or, you know, are you at the grocery store and like, or is it someone who you know is not realizing the impact of this and may use it in a more formal occasion?
Yes.
And so you want to help them,
yes,
guide them.
Yes.
Yes. Then you would explain the issue.
Okay. Let's go to Martha in Menominee. Hi.
Hi there. Oh, I love this show because I have so many pet peeves. I do kind of freelance writing from time to time. Music reviews and things like that, in a music sense, and also horses. I write articles about horses and horse training, so I kind of dabble in this, but I have found that I talk too much. My husband complains, my friends complain, I'm always babbling, as you can tell. So I have found the little word count button on my computer is one of my best friends, because mm-hmm. I tend to go on, and if I put myself on a little policeman, mm-hmm. with so many words, I'm only going to use so many words. And then I write what I want to write, and then I flip the word count button on, and I mm-hmm. find that it forces me to go back and take out all the fluff.
Yeah,
and it
that's
really,
great.
Really helps.
Mm-hmm. That,
my other
yeah.
comment is I think the people with the best grammar are those who were raised as really good readers.
Is there a connection between the two, would you say, Michelle?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, because you read, and just like we learn to speak by listening,
right?
The reading helps. You know, she makes such a great point. I sometimes assign my students very short pieces, and they think it's going to be easy, and it's not. It's really the hardest writing to do. And I talk to them about putting their writing on a diet, that we want. That sometimes they're giving me writing that's like a can of soda with lots of calories but not a lot of nutrition, and so they have to cut out the fat and the sugar.
It's one of the reasons I think I like poetry so much, is because right. so much care has been put into every single word, exactly the right word if it's good has been chosen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And having students, even students who aren't in a creative writing class, try writing poetry is a great way to really get their attention on what each word does and can do.
Yes. Jean on Facebook says, I'm 85 years old and so glad I was educated in England, in schools where all English tests and year-end exams took place in essay form. There were no true, false, or multiple choice tests. We did so much reading that recognizing correct grammar and spelling just came naturally. I can't recall much time spent on diagramming. Math was the only subject not requiring essay answers. She says, I still write columns for the local paper, and I'm amazed how many well-educated people feel they could not do this.
Oh, that's first of all, so wonderful and good for her.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a real shame. You know, I said, I think, somewhere in the article about how as soon as people find out that I teach writing, I start hearing the, oh, I can't do it, I'm no good, I avoid it. And they are very smart, interesting, engaging people who absolutely could. But they're just they're afraid.
Thanks for all of those comments. Let's move on to Ivy in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Well, hi. I have two comments. One is that I agree completely with your guest. I went to a college where it was integrated studies, and you write about the subject you're interested in. But about the grammar, when I was in eighth grade, I realized that because my parents corrected my grammar a lot, that I was setting a path for college prep. And I thought about the other kids that I was going to school with, that they already had so much more to overcome, because to them, me and John went to the store sounded normal. And so then they had to relearn all that sort of thing. And so I think it's really important to teach kids at least the basics. But I do agree that writing about things that you enjoy and learning the grammar through that, too, is really a way to go. But I get concerned about kids being pigeonholed as not very bright or whatever because of their grammar. Anyway. Well,
right. Thank you. Thanks. And that, unfortunately, mm-hmm. that can happen to a person, that you can get pigeonholed.
Mm-hmm.
You might be brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but your language will betray you.
Right. That's right. There's a wonderful program for elementary school kids out of Teachers College and of Columbia University that's the Reading and Writing Project. And that it sounds like it's what she did, but it's in grammar school where the kids are writing about stuff they're engaged in, and then they're collaboratively reading each other, asking each other questions, getting feedback, so that they're engaged with writing and with the ideas of expressing themselves right away, at the same time as then the teacher's giving them focused feedback about their use of language. So to my mind, that combines the best. They're not put off by language. They don't get the idea that how they use language is wrong.
Right.
They're learning different ways to use language. Mm.
Thanks, Ivy, for the call. We'll take more in a moment. We, this hour, are talking about how we learn grammar, how we can improve our grammar, and whether or not this business of diagramming sentences is just way out of date, and it makes more sense for us to concentrate on writing, to jump right into writing, and we'll learn the grammar along the way and into reading. Our guest is the author of a piece that's in the current issue of The Atlantic, and it's on our Facebook page, in case you haven't seen it. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The article titled, "The Wrong Way to Teach Grammar, No More Diagramming Sentences, Students Learn More from Simply Writing and Reading." Michelle Navarre-Cleary, Associate Professor and Associate Dean at DePaul University's School for New Learning and a fellow with the Op-Ed Project, is our guest, and we'll take more of your phone calls. Did I give you the number? I do it so often. I can't remember. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff in Madison is our next caller. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, this is something I'm actually, as a former English teacher, pretty passionate about. And it's interesting. I've asked parents of friends of my son, who's a high schooler, whether any of their kids have had grammar. And none of them have. In fact, one parent told me her daughter's teacher told her that it's not necessary. They don't need it. Well, that may be if they learn in other ways. But I just would like to emphasize, my son just took the SATs. And the one test that is probably, unfortunately, the most important test in their life still has grammar very much on it, and these kids have not been taught it at all. So they are being tested for it to get into college, but they haven't had any formal training in it whatsoever. So I personally believe that either A, they should teach it, or B, someone should talk to the college boards that it's not necessary anymore.
And what's
I will listen.
Wait, Jeff, are you still there?
Yeah.
Don't go away. When you take the test, is there a grammar portion? And if so, what kinds of questions are asked?
Well, I didn't take it, but I went over it with him. Went over pieces of it, and there are places online you can look at it. And
right.
They actually have very, very nuanced. They have sentences with nuanced errors in it, and they'll have little, what do you call it, a caret or underneath, you know, a break up the sentence into parts. And so it can become a multiple choice question. They say, is there an error in part A or part B or part C? And it could be something with punctuation. It could be me and him would be the easiest thing on there. I mean, I used to teach English, and there were stuff I really had to think about before I could get the answer. And I didn't get them all. So the college board, the most important test in any college-headed kid's life, still tests for it, but the teachers are saying they don't need it. There's a real disjuncture here.
Yes, thank you for calling. That's important. What about that, Michelle?
Well, multiple things. I wonder, first of all, whether when those teachers are saying that that they don't need it, what they mean is, and I would be curious to go back to them and have those parents go back to them, what they mean is that they're not teaching it in the, you know, as separate, standalone, as opposed to teaching it integrated with teaching writing. So that would be just a question that would be useful to know and to ask the schools what they are doing to prepare the kids for the test, because I have a son who's now a freshman in college, so we just went through all of that, and I have a daughter who's in high school. And yes, it's a high-stakes test, so you want to know what your school is doing to prepare your kids for the test. I believe that the SAT is undergoing a big change over the next year. And I haven't been paying attention to it because I have a small break because my high schooler is a freshman.
Right.
But it's true that the SAT, what the SAT is testing on writing, in many ways has very little to do with what colleges are looking for in students with writing.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for your call. It behooves everyone to find out what the grammar section is, because that is an important test before you take it. Bob in Fond du Lac, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I was a high school English teacher since the late 1970s, and I've seen the whole thing. I just retired a few years ago, and it was incredible. I've seen amazing width and breadth of excellence to dysfunction in the teaching of writing, and I was amazed to suddenly come up with some creative ideas that were only superseded by the individuals who beat me to it, you know, years before. And what happened was, I think that really grammar is an essential thing to be taught, but it should be taught, I feel, in conjunction at best, or at very least in conjunction with, or at best, as an advanced high school course. Once the kids are fluent in the writing process and the writing development of ideas, it really comes to a point where, as the former caller was talking about, the nuanced mistakes and so on need to be looked at to surely envision accuracy on the part of their writing development. And I initially started in a grammar course that taught nothing but grammar. My department was very hidebound and refused to teach any writing whatsoever until the kids got to be juniors or seniors. That resulted in massive writing failure. And finally, what I decided to do was I decided to have individuals, well, we changed the curriculum after I got a little more sway in the department, and we went into writing. And then eventually, the technique I used in teaching that was very effective was that no kid wrote one essay. They always wrote redrafts of essays. The publishing thing is the big scary part for them, and writing is a process, and it's a never-ending process as you develop your education and your fluency. I just really want to commend the guest you have today, and want to thank her for her efforts that she's put out there, because I am so passionate about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I love the fact all these former English teachers are listening, or English teachers. It's great. You just find the audience.
We are legion. We are legion.
I guess so. Yeah, it's great. Thank you very much, Bob, for the call. When she was going to middle school, her eighth grade year, she was supposed to be taught grammar, but the teacher was terrible and they never learned it. When she attended high school, she got A's in English, surprising all. Maybe we don't need to drill grammar, she asks. Maybe we don't need to drill grammar?
Drilling doesn't do anything. I mean, really, frankly, things you've memorized, they leave your head unless you practice them and use them. And it's in the using and practicing that you come to own those ideas, and you come to say, aha, here I go again. This is one of my things I know I do, and I'm going to fix it.
Mm. I think all those rules have to rhyme, because those are the ones you remember. I before E, except after C. Remember that? Then you remember them. They've got some kind of a rhyme. Calvin in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Calvin.
Yes, so I had a question, or I guess if your guest could make a confirmation, that when people would say things like, there's no more, or that's no good, that would be grammatically incorrect. And if so, why would they say that versus saying there isn't any more, or that is not good, as an example.
So why would they say it? Because for the same reason people say me and Joe are going to the store, right? Because that's the way that language is used that they're most familiar with.
Right. And so it begs the question, do we need a standardized form of speaking English? Is it incorrect to say that? And do we need to know that it's incorrect? Or is it okay to say that?
I would argue that it's impossible to get one standardized form of any language. Mm-hmm. And moreover, that we don't really want to, because all of the variation and differences enrich our language, right? We kind of... words come in and out of various different contexts in which we use language. And really, the best writers are those who realize that language is flexible and adaptable and have ideas about how they can use language in different ways to suit different audiences.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, sometimes I ask my students, tell me what happened to you yesterday. I'm the teacher. Now tell me what happened to you yesterday. I'm your best friend. Now tell me what happened to you yesterday. Or sometimes I say last night, I'm your parent. what happened yesterday? I'm your lawyer. What happened last night? I'm your therapist. And the ways that they're going to use language are going to change because of those different audiences. And it would not be appropriate to talk as formally as they might to a lawyer, to their friends. Their friends would be like, what's going on with you?
What's up, man? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude? No, dude. So what's up, dude? Thanks very much, Calvin, for the call. Let's go to Michael in Waukesha. Hi, Michael.
Hi, I'm 68. I have a bachelor's in English. We had, I went to Catholic school. We diagrammed sentences for 4 years. I had grammar all through high school, but what the question I want to know is, why a lot of, you read novels and articles in newspapers and magazines now, and when did it become acceptable to write in incomplete sentences? Because you see there are all these incomplete sentences in contemporary novels and articles, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Is that mm-hmm. now considered grammatically okay?
I'll tell you a funny story, and then I'll answer your question. In writing this piece, so I'm an academic. I do academic writing usually. In writing this piece, I was part of a project that was helping academics write for more public audiences. So I had a person who was coaching me on this, and she kept going in my writing and putting in, you'll see, like dashes where I wouldn't put dashes and changing things around. So, and she's like, your writing has to be more conversational, more sparkly. So, yes. I even got a lesson in how, as you continue to do, in how to adjust your writing. But the idea, really, the goal is to know that you're doing a sentence fragment, for example, and to be doing it on purpose for an effect that you want to happen.
Mm-hmm. And is more of that being done, Michael asked?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I see it even in academic writing, which is, so published in academic journals. It's more informal. There's more eyes, which you would never see before. There's more. And in part of that, it comes from a whole theoretical idea that obscuring who the author is and their subject position is allowing for a bias that's not recognized. So better to acknowledge your position, which brings the eyes in and brings a more informal and narrative style into the writing, but also locates the position of the person who's making some argument.
Thank you so much, Michael, for your call. Well, Michelle, this has been a delightful hour. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you and to hear from so many interesting listeners. You talk about grammar and language, and people are there in full force. It's wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for writing the article.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Michelle Navar-Cleary, she's associate professor and associate dean at DePaul University's School for New Learning and a fellow with the Op-Ed Project. The Wrong Way to Teach Grammar is the name of the article. It's in The Atlantic, and it's on our Facebook page at The Kathleen Dunn Show. You'll find it provocative, I'm sure. And the comments section is as interesting as our comments today on this program. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'll be looking at defective cars and why nobody knew about the defects for way too long a time.